All right, I want to move us on to our interview. Speaking of cool and making things cool, Flans, that's his cool name from They Might Be Giant. He was kind enough to talk to us about his new CD, Here Comes Science, and I kind of want to preface this interview by saying that it turned out a little bit more unconventional than I expected, more conversational in nature. And before I had a chance to even welcome him, he started asking me questions.
Well, I mean, what are the main issues in like the world? I mean, there's a lot of sort of conspiracy debunking people who call themselves skeptics, but I don't think of skeptics as being so wrapped up in religion, you know, if you know what I mean, or versus science.
You know, sometimes we have to divide the two between atheism and skepticism, because when the two get conflated, it becomes a little bit of a problem with like other parents or, you know, at schools. You know, if we wanted to have like a skeptics group at a school and people were conflating that with atheism, then that becomes a problem. That seems like it might even become a problem with your album, because, you know, say a Christian was buying the album and they listened to the song that includes angels as an untruth.
Well, it doesn't say it's an untruth. I mean, in fact, I mean, as a songwriter, you know, the lyric of the song is quite specific in its word choice. I mean, the actual lyric is, I like the stories about angels, unicorns, and elves just as much as anybody else. And I think, you know, that is very true. You know, I mean, we, you know, most of our lives as writers and performers and it's been sort of wrapped up in things that are very much from the imagination and you know, we're as hypnotized by the unreal as anyone. You know, to us, you know, things that are metaphors and poetics are as big a part of like a larger life truths as a lot of scientific information. So kind of understanding the distinction between the two is also meaningful. Honestly, this song was written in a slightly lighthearted way. I mean, there's a part of it that's just, the second verse is just kind of jamming a definition of the scientific method into a series of couplets, and that is such an absurd kind of writing chore. And the first verse just kind of sets up what that idea is. But, you know, I guess, you know, I think it's easy to misinterpret the song as just being cavalier about religious beliefs. But, you know, that's not really the point, you know. And, you know, it's not, you know, I don't know. I mean, I grew up in a pretty religious setting, and I
would you consider yourself a non-believer now, though?
Yeah, I'm a non-believer. I'm an atheist, to be perfectly honest. You know, people seem very afraid to say the term atheist.
I'm atheist, too. I'm not afraid.
Yeah. I think it's intellectually dishonest to not say it. You know, if that's the way you feel, you shouldn't live in fear. But you know, we're coming out of a very dark political time where people were, I think very fearful of the government and very fearful of how things were going. So it's no big surprise.
Well, and absolutely. I mean, that's part of this podcast, is kind of giving a place to families who are atheists or secular humanists. We like to maybe give that title so that we can say more what we believe in rather than what we don't believe in. But giving them a place and a community, and we're connected to the Foundation Beyond Belief, and that's a charitable organization that kind of focuses the energy of atheists and gives them ideas of charitable or charities that people can donate to.
It's a great name. Beyond Belief is a very good name.
You were asking earlier about what is skepticism, or what does that mean to us? And, you know, a lot of times it is looking at claims like alternative medicine, conspiracies you mentioned, and pseudoscience, and saying, well, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and, you know, looking at science and reasoning and seeing, you know, what do those tools have to say about these claims. So your album opening with Science is Real, it almost seems like a skeptic anthem. Under those terms, would you think of yourself as a skeptic?
Well, you know, I would suppose so. We spend a bit of time every year just driving around in a tour bus with a whole bunch of fellows. It's kind of like being in a boot camp or something. There's 12 guys on the bus, and it's the conversations get pretty loose. But a lot of times, conspiracy theory type conversations come up, and they're very volatile. Lived through the fallout of 9/11, driving out of New York, just a couple of days afterwards to catch up with our tour that on the other side of the country, it was a very harrowing time. But if the conspiracy theories about 9/11, kind of drive me loco, just because it's already like as unlikely a scenario as possible. Like you don't have to add layers of conspiracy theory on top of it. There was a fascinating episode of Democracy Now! A few years back with, I believe, an editor from, might have actually been an editor from Popular Science, I'm not sure, that had dedicated a whole issue to debunking or examining the conspiracies around 9/11. And they had the filmmaker, a young man, the young man who produced whatever it is, the Change movie, whatever it's called.
Yes, Loose Change.
Change.
I do remember that. I think it was on the History Channel, maybe, or also Popular Mechanics debunked it.
Oh, that's what it was. Popular Mechanics, not Popular. Yeah, Popular Mechanics. The fellow from Popular Mechanics was just really dismantled the whole thing so artfully and so diplomatically, and you know, he really didn't have a big axe to grind. You know, he just was like, hey, you know, let's just, you know, you're making serious charges, let's just back up a little bit and talk about the whole thing. It's so strange. My dad was an architect, and I grew up with, you know, many of his friends who were structural engineers and you know, people involved in really developing high-rise technology, you know, like building tremendously tall buildings all around the world. And they would come over for dinner, and they would have these long conversations about all the things that they had to figure out how to do. And I'm, you know, as a kid, you know, you're obsessed with explosions and things like that. And the whole idea of implosion was something that I had heard about at a very early age, relating to the demolition of these skyscraper buildings. And so when the World Trade Towers imploded the way they did, it didn't really come as a big surprise to me. I remember actually having a conversation with my dad shortly after it happened, and he was like, "Yeah, you know, it's strange because it's almost like a textbook example of what they were told that, you know, because they, when those buildings were built, there was a mandate for them to be able to be taken down. You know, I mean, that you couldn't just, you can't just build a building anymore and just say, like, we don't know how it's going to come down. You know, we're just, you know, it's like, you know, you have to, you're not just going to be relying on a engineered explosion to make it come down onto itself. So, you know, it was odd to have this enormous callback to my childhood when that 9/11 thing happened, but it was in no way a surprise. But obviously, to a lot of people who didn't grow up listening to structural engineers talking about implosions, it's the most unlikely part. You know, they're just wondering why it didn't fall over sideways like a million other big things do. So
right. Well, and then my big argument is, why would we attack our own defense headquarters? Or if we thought that flying a plane into a building would cause a war, why would we fly two planes into buildings? You know, one would be sufficient.
Right.
We would never fly two planes into World Trade Center. We wouldn't even do one. I mean, that's such a ridiculous idea. But,
well,
you know,
but
to conflate
is,
that to two.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. You know, I guess I have a lot of questions. So do you guys just get hassled down completely?
Well, you know, the things that we write about, for instance, like vaccines, like, do they cause autism? No,
right,
they don't.
Right.
We, you know, anybody Googling that's going to come straight to us and attack us. And a lot of people have already made up their mind. You know,
sure.
a skeptic principle is having an open mind, is being willing to change your mind, giving the evidence.
Right.
And we have a lot of people that come on and say, you're sheeple, big pharma, you know, you're just listening to whatever big pharma says, you know, rather than actually, well, let's look at the evidence, you know, is your idea plausible? Is there scientific evidence for it? Is it good scientific evidence?
Right.
So
did you hear there was an episode of On the Media, which is a really, really top flight public radio show out of New York City, out of WNYC. I guess they were talking about, it's called The Lancet, I think is the name of the medical journal that first floated the idea that vaccines might be a cause of autism, and I guess they've withdrawn or retracted the story. And it was really interesting.
It's amazing to me it took them so long, because already 10 out of 12 of the original authors retracted that article, that publication. So, I mean,
but, you know,
it's
like anything else. It's very hard, you know, it's very hard to unscramble an egg. You know, it's like once you get an idea into the culture and it kind of, it can have a life of its own. It's very hard to convince people that you know, once they're suspicious of something on that level, that it isn't. And you know, I mean, speaking of skepticism, you know, I think people have a reason to be skeptical about big pharma and skeptical about the government. I mean, there's evil in this world. You know, there's some bad stuff. You know, there are people who are really not looking out for the general public and doing stuff that's not cool.
I mean, absolutely. And like, I don't want to be an apologist for big pharma. I have my own problems with, you know, pharmaceutical companies, but people can't just make claims without having some evidence to support it just because, you know, pharmaceutical companies want to make a profit.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But you can see how, you know, if you're, I mean, I have so much sympathy for, you know, for parents who are in that situation where they feel like the medical establishment is probably giving them so little information and it has so few real answers to what's going on with their child. You know, it's such a difficult thing to have, you know, to have to wrap your mind around. And, you know, because it's like an infant onset problem, it seems like it's being caused. I don't know. I mean, I'm so sympathetic, and I can just see how those events, how easy the events of having your kid vaccinated and then seeing this huge change in their behaviors, how easy it would be to connect the dots on that idea. You know, it's like they just see it as like a cause and effect.
You were talking earlier about not being able to unscramble an egg, that kind of brings me to your song "Why Does the Sun Shine." When you guys first released that, it was kind of like scrambling an egg, because it mentioned that the sun is a mass of incandescent gas, but it turns out that it's not gas, that it's the fourth state of matter. I wanted you to talk a little bit about that song. First of all, I was surprised that that's a cover song.
Yeah, I mean, we recorded that song along. We started performing that song very early on in the band, and recorded it kind of in the middle of our tenure at Elektra Records as like as part of an EP. And it's kind of taken on a life of its own. We've recorded it in a bunch of different incarnations as well. We did a rock version as well as it's sort of a traditional version of the song. It was more like the original, which has got this kind of strange lullaby thing to it. It's from a great album of songs that was recorded for kids by Tom Glaser, and High Zaret was the co-writer, and we actually cover another song off that album, "What Is a Shooting Star," on our new Science record. It's kind of silly. I mean, like the first time we recorded it, it had this sort of charming appeal of kind of those 50s, that really profoundly awkward infotainment moment where people are just writing educational songs for kids and just jamming in a whole lot of information, and maybe not so artfully, and you kind of feel the information, you know, busting out the seams of the song a little bit. And that was what was kind of interesting and about it for us. It was just a very different kind of song and sort of an absurd song. Then as we were making this record, we realized that we were going to be called on to include that song, since it's such a notable part of our repertoire. You know, but at the same time, there was this nagging problem that since the song was written in the 50s, with a lot of the lyrics taken from an encyclopedia, there had been this kind of shift in the idea of what the sun was actually made of. The answer song that we wrote, "Why Does the Sun Really Shine," actually has, it's a pretty lighthearted response. I mean, it gets a little bit sidetracked in the lyrics. You know, I mean, there's a line about the sun not being made of fire, and the previous song doesn't say that the sun is made of fire, but it was really just more thinking about like how like little kids just think of the sun as being made of fire. But I think it confuses, it probably confuses the issue more than anything else. But, you know, the idea that science is an ever-evolving thing is probably not such a bad idea to plant in people's heads.
Oh, I was going to say, because you decided to add "Why Does the Sun Shine" to the new album, even though you had to issue a correction right after. And was that on purpose, to show that, you know, science be updated?
Well, it's not so. Yes, exactly. But it also, you know, it's not so wrong. I mean, there's you know, except for the title,
right?
A lot of the information in the original song is actually valid. So, you know, we just kind of rolled with it. We are not scientists, you know, and we're just pretending to be educators. So, I feel like I'm on a very thin ice, having to explain, you know, how we could put forward a song that's already been essentially debunked. But I don't think it's the worst thing in the world for people to hear a song that is a little bit out of date. There are a lot of out of date songs that are still my favorite songs.
Well, one song that we really like is My Brother the Ape. That's one that Dale McGowan, the guy who wrote Parenting Beyond Belief, Foundation Beyond Belief, he just wrote about that on his blog. Just how perfect that song is to talk about how uncomfortable people feel about the idea that we're related to apes, but doesn't matter if you're uncomfortable. You know, we're still all cousins. Can you tell me a little bit about that song?
Well, that song really comes from the desk of John Linnell, so I'm a little bit reluctant to talk about it too definitively. But the thing I find actually very engaging about the song is how it actually jumps off from the man-ape issue and gets to the notion that all living things are essentially linked. And
right, my sister the cow.
Yeah, exactly. And that's an idea that I think, in the times that we live in with the sort of environmental challenges that we have in front of us, I think it's actually very useful to remember that. I think human beings can be very selfish about what we feel we're bringing to the world. We have a real superiority complex, and sometimes we kind of get confused as to what our real place in this planet is. So it frames the issue really, really nicely, and I like that. And it frames it in kind of a gentle way, which I think is cool.
We were talking yesterday, those of us who host the podcast, and we were talking about the best way to give the sex talk to your kids. One thing that I brought up was, why not use a metaphor, like planting a garden? And it was brought to my attention that kids don't understand metaphors, that they'll get confused and think that there's plants and soil in there. But then I noticed in your album that there's a lot of metaphors going on. Are you worried that, like, kids will think that there really is a colorful man at the end of the rainbow, or that there really is a little car traveling around in your blood?
Well, that's an interesting point. I wouldn't really know how to speak to that in a direct way. Kids are different from each other, and some kids understand the world through metaphor, in a very direct way. They really get it, and it's actually a really valuable way to explain different things. But I think our biggest challenge when approaching these things, these sort of fact-based albums, is finding where the poetry is for us. We have to write songs about this stuff, and writing a song is a very different challenge than writing an essay about it. It's way past it's compressed thought, and it's kind of have to get an idea aloft, and so we rely on metaphors, and hopefully it isn't causing too much confusion, but I don't know. It's a good point. I mean, especially on the science album.
Well, thank you so much, John Flansburg, and thank you for coming on Podcast Beyond Belief.
Hey, thank you, and good luck.